Boker Tov. Good morning. Welcome to everybody. It's great to see everybody on this nice, beautiful, sunny Yerushalayim morning. We are in the middle of a topic. I'd like to refresh you a little bit from last week to just bring you up to speed what we did. Next week, just a little bit of prior notice. We finished this topic this week. Next week, we're going to have the last installment on our discussion about Tumah and Tahara and Kohanim. I'd like to deal in one session with the topic of Kohanim being doctors and becoming doctors and hospitals and things like that. There's a lot of thought that's gone into this. If anyone's ever been to Shaare Tzedek Hospital, they'll see that the hospital is very much designed and there are noticed signs go up all over the place about Kohanim this, Kohanim that. And therefore we'll see this is something of a chokhmah, and we need to spend, now that we're in it, a little bit of time, just one session on that. A little bit of advance notice, in 3 weeks from now, please God, Wednesday will be Tu B'Shvat. And my understanding is, yes, the year's rolling on, my understanding is that there will be a series of shirim that morning, themed around Tu B'Shvat. We'll certainly be having a shir that morning in our shir around Tu B'Shvat ideas and themes, and that's something to look forward to from there. So let's have a look at part two. Let's just refresh ourselves of the story so far, okay? We have our Mr. Cohen, who wants to fly for business or for pleasure on an aeroplane, and he has two problems. Number one, does the aeroplane itself contain a mate, a casket being transported for burial in Israel, in which case does that affect him sitting in the passenger area? And number two, is the plane going to fly over a Jewish cemetery? They are the two questions. We saw there was a third question, which is, what if, God forbid, somebody dies on the flight in the middle of the passenger section? What can you do? On such things, Einas de Rachmana Patre. That's where the Gemara says, if you're Einas, so there's nothing you can do, you're effectively Patur and don't have to worry about that. But does he have to worry about flying over the cemetery or the mace on the plane? Oh, we saw last time, excuse me, that there are many, many flights which do have a mace. In fact, most flights out of JFK in America, in New York, do have a mace. And therefore, does he have to worry? And we saw the main problem here is that the tumor will penetrate through the plane. And the question is, can you find out a way to, if you like, block in that tumor? The way to block tumor is through a gag, is through kind of oil, some kind of a structure, which is a roof structure, oil, hachotzet, which blocks in the tumor. And we saw last time that it may be possible to do certain things to help the Kohen. We may be able to construct some kind of plastic ohel, because in order to block tumor, the ohel has to not be itself makabel tumor. It's not to be something which is susceptible to tumor. So maybe we can design, and we saw El Al put together with the help of various halachic authorities, a plastic ohel structure which goes around the casket. Maybe that works to close it in. Maybe we can say that the floor of the passenger section, this is all revision from last week, the floor of the passenger section will actually block the tumah itself so that Mr. Cohen can sit happily on the top level and the cargo hold is blocked off. And we looked last week at whether that would work. The floor of the plane is made out of some kind of metal. What kind of metal is that? Is that aluminum? Is that steel? And is it makabel tumah? Isn't it makabel tumah? Will it work to block the tumah? That we talked about last week. And then we said last week, finally, that even if the floor of the plane will not work, and even if the casket, the plastic thing we designed around and the casket will not work, maybe the tumah will simply go straight through up, and it will go through the floor and through the ceiling of the plane and not spread at all. And therefore, all Mr. Cohen needs to worry about is that he's not sitting on a seat which is right above the body. If he can work out where that is, maybe that's okay. That it seems illogical to say that the tumor would go through the floor, but then not go through the ceiling, but spread around the passenger section. Unless, of course, and this could be, the ceiling was made out of a different substance than the floor. If, for example, the ceiling was made out of carbon fiber, whereas the floor was made out of metal, so that might be different. That might then go and spread, but we'd have to do our research on this. But all of the things that we said last week may be irrelevant. The whole shear may effectively be irrelevant, because if we're trying to block in tumor, so you need an ohel. An ohel, by definition, is attached to the ground. That's what a tent or a roof structure is. If you have a roof structure which is flying through the air at 800 miles an hour, can you even say that is any kind of halachic roof structure? Does that even count? And therefore we need to investigate. And today I think it's quite exciting. We're going to be dusting off corners of Mishnah and halachic issues that people don't often do and places that people don't often go. We need to ask ourselves about the question of Ohel Zaruk. Ohel Zaruk, the Gemara says, is an Ohel structure which is flying through the air. Does it work or does it not work? If you are trying to protect against Tumah and you have an Ohel which is not attached to the ground but flying through the air, the Gemara wants to address that. And there are actually three places in the Mishnayot and Brises which address that. One, we'll see, says that an Ohel Zaruk does work. One says that an Ohel Zaruk doesn't work. And the other one says, it's a machlokas. So let's have a look at the first one. An Ohel Zaruk. Look in source number one. This is a Mishnah in Ohelot, which we said last time may be pronounced Ahilot, but let's not get into that now. Let's call it Ohelot like people normally do. And the Mishnah here wants to give a list of Ohel structures which do block and Ohel structures which do not block. Elu, says the Mishnah here, these loy mevi'in, they will not spread the tumah, the loy choitesin, but they will not block it either, meaning these do not work as regular roofs. Hazra'im, plants. Hayirakot, vegetables, if you have some kind of vegetable roof. Hamukhubarim lekarka, which are still growing from the ground. Chutz min hayirakot shemanu, apart from those vegetables and trees, says the Mishnah that we listed earlier, which do form roofs. Now, I'm not getting into that in detail now, but let me just throw in parentheses, trees, depending on the nature of the tree, because we saw here some vegetables do not block tumah, but there are trees, certain trees which will. And this is a separate issue which we haven't even raised yet, which Kohanim also have to deal with, which is, if there is a Jewish cemetery with trees overhanging that cemetery, and those trees on the other side overhang a road or a sidewalk or a pavement, something of that nature, a Kohen may have a shaila as to whether he is able to drive or walk down that road. Because the tree, again, is overhanging the graves on one side, overhanging the road on the other side, and when the Kohen drives under the road, on the road, then he may become Tame, which is a problem. There are such roads, and I brought you here in the footnote in number one, the CRC has official recommendation. I'll just read you what it says in footnote number one. The CRC, Chicago Rabbinical Council, says, Tumah can be transferred from a grave by overhanging trees. It may be possible for the tumor to spread from tree to tree. This applies whether one is walking, cycling, or riding in a car. Meaning, if you wanted to say that the car was an Ohel itself to protect you, then we get back to the very question we're asking, which, does a moving Ohel count as an Ohel? Therefore, the CRC recommends the following. A Kohen should circumvent any tree branches that overhang both a Jewish cemetery and a road walkway. Such tree branches are present at, and then it lists a number of cemeteries. If the tree branches overhang a non-Jewish cemetery, it's preferable to avoid the overhanging tree limbs. Preferable, because as we saw last week with non-Jewish graves, even though the Shulchan Aruch paskens that it is better for the Kohen to avoid any tent structure with a non-Jewish grave, it is not as serious, even though we try very hard to avoid it, it's not as serious. In London, I remember very distinctly there was a, usually with the Jewish cemeteries, this is not a problem, with Orthodox cemeteries, because Orthodox cemeteries try to make sure that there aren't any overhanging branches for this reason. But sometimes with Reform cemeteries, this is a problem. And in Hoop Lane, in London, if anyone knows London, this was an issue, because they used to say to the Kohanim that maybe you can drive down there in the winter, but don't drive down there in the summer. Why? What's the difference between the winter and the summer? Because in the winter there are no leaves on the trees, and therefore there's no canopy. In the summer, it's more of a problem. Although that is itself a question. It could be that this only applies with evergreens, which are always a roof, and it could apply with only certain types of branches, but I'm not getting into that now. So, vegetables, it's a shiloh, what kind of vegetable, what kind of trees. Let's go back into the source number one. Again, these are roof structures which do not give us a problem. The kipat habarad, an archway made of barad, of hail, vesheleg, and snow. Imagine you go to the northern Canada and there are structures made of snow. Go to Alaska, whatever. Vahakfor, or made of frost. Vahagid, or made of ice. Vahamelech, or melech, salt. Salt structures. It says, these do not spread tumah. By the way, before we finish this source, man-made fibers might be a problem. And another issue which is raised with Kohanim are umbrellas. What's with umbrellas? I'm not joking. This is a shaila. If you have a funeral in the rain, and there are people standing by their coffin, carrying the casket, holding umbrellas, and there is an unbroken sea of umbrellas. Everybody's standing there with an umbrella. So the Kohanim, who know that they have to stand well to the distance, may not realize that actually if the sea of umbrellas reaches them, they may be under a large ohel structure, which actually is matamavim, and they have to be aware of this. This is something that the poskim raised. So only bury people on sunny days, or if you're a Kohen, make sure that you're not near the umbrellas. So the Gemara went through, the Mishnah went through all of those structures which don't transfer. And this is the one we're really looking at in the last line of number one. The ha'os ha'poreach, a bird that's flying. You have a large eagle flying through the air. Don't worry about that. The talit ha'manafnefet. That's the one. A talit manafnefet. What is a talit manafnefet? Some kind of flying carpet. So in case you think it's just something hanging on a clothesline, just flapping in the wind, says the Tiferet Yisrael explains in Brashi script, no, it's not attached. She'enu kashur b'shum makom. It's not attached anywhere to a pole or to the ground. Rak haruach higbio. The wind has lifted up this flying talit, this flying carpet. V'hu ach ba'avir. And it's now flying through the air. So you, Mr. Cohen, are standing some way away from a grave, and then you see this flying carpet or flying talit come wafting through the air coming towards you. The question is, will this or will this not act as an ohel? And it says here, it does not. It does not work. This does not work as an ohel. And therefore, if you take this at face value, it seems that an ohel flying through the air, loishme ohel, is not called an ohel, and therefore all the plastic casket structures in the world will not help us, because once the plane takes off, it's not good. It might help when the plane's on the runway. It might help when the plane's on the ground. You've covered your coffin in a plastic ohel, but once the plane's flying through the air, it sounds like it doesn't work. That's one Mishnah. We now go over the page to Mishnah number two, which is a Mishnah in Para. What is Para? Para deals with the preparation of the ashes for the Para Aduma. This was critical. In order to become Tahor from Tumat Mate, it's not good enough to go to the mikveh. That won't work. You have to also be sprinkled with the ashes of the Para Aduma on day 3 and day 7 of a purification process. You can look at the psukim. It's all brought there in the Torah itself. Now, it's not just ashes. People sometimes don't realize this. The ashes have to be mixed with water. And it's a solution of water and the ashes of the Para Aduma, which is sprinkled on people. This everybody has to be familiar with. If you were going up to the Beit HaMikdash for Chag, then you have to become Tahor. And the Chazal described how people did this. If you were rich and you could afford a suite in the Inbal for Sukkos, which you have to be pretty rich to do that, you could hire your own private fellow to come and sprinkle you. You'd go there a week in advance. He'd come on day 3, on day 7, and you go to the mikveh and everything's good. If you were hoi polloi and you can't afford your suite in the Inbal, so says the Gemara, so don't worry. You only needed one drop of this stuff to hit you on day 3 and day 7. So they used to have streets in Yerushalayim with people standing in open windows, like a car wash type structure, where they used to be spritzing people with and you just make sure you go down the street on, you know, day 3 and day 7 that you're becoming Tahor. You'd be spritzed a little bit on down the street. This was something that everybody had to bear in mind, and we will also, once Tum and Tara become relevant again, have to get used to this. To us, it seems like, you know, rocket science. How does this work? This is not much different to how people used to relate 300 or 400 years ago to Shemitah. Shemitah! It's like, when Mashiach comes, we'll have to think about Shemitah. You know, who has land in Israel? Jews don't own land in Israel. Nothing grows in Israel. Shemitah is like for your Mashiach. Now, you and I know that Shemitah is Rami Levi, this Hechsher, that Hechsher, this Hechsher, Hetzah Mechira, Oitzah Beis Din, etc. We've got used to it. Now, Shemitah is like Shabbos and Kashrus, part of our halachic lexicon. So one day also, these issues too will become that. So you have to be sprinkled with the water of the Para Aduma, the ashes of Paramadula. So obviously, what's absolutely essential is to make sure that these waters themselves do not become Tameh. Because if the water becomes Tameh, you really ruined everything from the very beginning. So they went to exceptional lengths to make sure that this water was not Tameh. Now, you have to draw this water from the Shiloach, which, as you know, is the spring down by Yerushalayim. That was the best place to draw it from. It has to be from a spring. Who's going to draw it? Well, you could try and be Matahir somebody first in order to draw the water, but it becomes a little bit of a catch-22. You know, you need someone who is Tahor to draw the water, but you need the water to make them Tahor, etc. So how are we going to get people who for sure are 1,000%, no question about it, tahor. Who is the best person to choose? So, a child, presumably, who has not come into contact with any dead body. But how are you going to make sure of that? Because if you today went to a hospital and took a newborn child, they're all tame already. Because the hospital, as we'll talk about next week, is probably all tame anyway. So the minute the child is born in a situation of tumah. So you need to work out a situation which will not do that. So look at number two. Says the Mishnah in Parah in the third parak. Chatzerot hayu b'Yerushalayim. They used to have special courtyards in Jerusalem. Bnuyot al gabe sela, which were built over stone, v'tachtehem chalul, which had a hollow under the stone, mipnei kever hatahoim. What's kever hatahoim? Just in case there happened to be an unknown dead body somewhere buried under the ground in Yerushalayim, you know, one had everyone forgotten about. They found they were courtyards which they were built over a stone structure, which like a ledge, where there was a hollow underneath. So there's no way that if there was any dead body there, then it would not, the tumah would not go through because there was like a roof structure. So they would find these courtyards, which for sure, even a dead body under the courtyard wouldn't cause trouble. Umevim nashim ubarot. They would bring pregnant women there during their pregnancy. V'yoladot sham. And they would give birth. They set up a clinic in these courtyards, and the pregnant women would give birth there. Umegadlot sham et b'neihem, and they would raise the children there. They had a whole creche, pre-K, K, you know, schooling, so they had the whole thing worked out in those courtyard areas, and the kids would grow up there. So now you have a kid who for sure has never been subject to any kind of tumor. So how are you going to get that kid to the shiloach to draw the water? Umeivin shvarim, they brought oxen. Va'al gadehem delatot, and they had big wooden boards like doors on top of the oxen. And they sat the kids on these boards, and they rode this special souped-up ox, this special conditioned ox, okay, down through the streets of Jerusalem with this board on the top. The kosot shel evan biyadam. They held cups with made of stone, which is not a kabbal tumah. He gyul shiloach. When they got to the shiloach, yardu malom. They got down and they filled up the cups. Ba'alu v'yashvu agabeim. And they rode the oxes back to the courtyard again. Okay, very interesting Mishnah. I don't know if people have ever heard this Mishnah before. That's the way they would get the water in the most pristine form, tahor form, into the Beit HaMikdash, etc. Now, what's going on? By the way, I brought you a picture here. My son remembered that he had a picture in one of his books from Machon HaMikdash. If the picture came out okay on the copy. But they drew here a picture of these guys with the ox and the boards. And the little boys sitting on top. Everybody watching, very excited. And them drawing water from the shiloach. Now, what's the purpose of this door? Why are they all riding on a wooden beam, a wooden board? And the answer is to make an ohel. So there's an ohel structure. Ah, but isn't this a moving ohel? This is an ohel on the move. This is an ohel zaruk. It sounds from this that a moving ohel is a good ohel. Because otherwise, why would you make a board on the top of an ox? It's also moving, and they're not bothered. They're not worried about this. This appears to move. So this Mishnah in Parah seems to indicate that a moving ohel, okay, it's not flying through the air, we'll deal with that soon, a moving ohel does work as an ohel, and therefore here we see a precedent that maybe our plastic structure on the plane could work. So this is a Mishnah which seems to say, unlike the Mishnah in Oholot, which says it doesn't work, this one says it does. The third Mishnah, it's actually a brisa, is a machlokes. Look at number three. Number three is a Mishnah about somebody who flies the chutz la'aretz, okay, in a wooden tower flying through the air. Tower flying through the air. Says, now, chutz la'aretz, in case you haven't noticed, is tameh, is impure. Chazal actually gave everywhere in chutz la'aretz a din of tumah on a rabbinic level, so no Kohen was allowed to go to chutz la'aretz under normal circumstances, because the Kohen will become tamei. Just stepping into chutz la'aretz, this obviously doesn't apply today because everybody is tamei in Israel, out of Israel anyway, but in the time when people were careful about this, so chutz la'aretz itself, and there are very specific borders, the minute you stepped over the border, you became tamei. So the question is, okay, fine, if somebody walks over the border, they become tamei. What if somebody flies over the border? Says the Mishnah, says the Braiser here. What if you fly over the border in some kind of a tower or a box? Is that the same? So look at number three. The Tanya. Hanichnas le'eret ha'amim. If you enter into the land of the non-Jews, Ayin Chutz La'aretz, b'shida teva u'migdal, in a box or a closet or a tower. Okay? And you go over. Now it could be someone was carrying it, it could be you were flying through the air, whatever. So So what's the story? Rebbe Matame. Rebbe says, sorry, doesn't work. Doesn't work. It doesn't protect you. You're Tame if you're flying through the air. Rebbe Yosef, Rebbe Yehuda, Matahir. Rebbe Yosef, Rebbe Yehuda says, you're Tahor. But my commitment to you, what are they disagreeing on, says the Gemara? Well, it's simple. Marasava Oel Zorek Lav Shmei Oel. One, the one that says it doesn't work says an Oel Zorek does not work as an Oel. Well, Marasava, and the other one says Oel Zorek Shmei Oel does work as an Oel. So here in this third case, there's somebody flying into Chutz La'aretz in a box. So there, there's a machlokas. One says an Oel Zorek does work. One says an Oel Zorek doesn't work. Where does that leave us? That leaves us with a rather complicated situation, yes? Okay, good. So you want to say this could be a Durabonim, but they're saying that at the end of the day, it's a question of Ohel Zorok. Does Ohel Zorok work? And if it works for this, then it would work for that. Unless you want to say that the one who is Makel, is lenient, he's only lenient because it's a rabbinic din. That would be an intelligent thing to say. Maybe that's what you'll say. Halacha Lemaisa. The Rambam paskens this way, and we'll see a certain way on the top of page 3. Go to page 3, please. Hamahalech Be'eretz Ha'akum. Don't forget the Rambam brings all the halachas for all time, not just practical halachas that apply today, but the Rambam wants you to be able to use his book even when all the laws of Tumah and Tahorah will once again apply. So he brings you the halacha. Hamahalech be'eretz ha'akum. If you travel to Chutz La'aretz, Tamei Tumat Shiva, you become Tamei, the Tumat Shiva, which is Tumat Met, as I said, on a rabbinic level. And then he says, Hanichnas le'eretz ha'akum, b'shidah keivah u'mikdal. If you manage to travel to Chutz La'aretz in one of these towers or boxes, ha-porchim ba'avir, he says, look how he says it, porchim ba'avir, flying through the air. You manage to travel there flying through the air, tamei, doesn't work. Sha'ohel zaruk, eino kroy ohel. An ohel zaruk doesn't work. And this is the majority of the Rishonim Paskin this way, like the Rambam, that an ohel zaruk doesn't work at all. Now, at this stage, Mr. Cohen has a problem on the plane. Because all the plastic structures or analyses of this could be an OL, that could be an OL, they won't work. They'll be fine when he's sitting on the tarmac, but the minute that the plane takes off, then everything's going to just break through and the OL won't work. So what is he going to do? So far it doesn't look too good for our Cohen. There is a minority opinion of the Rashba, who says that an OL Zorok does work, but he's a minority really of one and not many others. And the question is it legitimate for our Kohen to rely on such a minority? This is an issue of a Doraita. Can he rely on that? Well, is it a Doraita? You see, the Pnei Yeshua says in number 5, look here, number 5, Rali Boru. I think he's quite clear, even though there's a machlokas on this, the high tana de svirele oil zorok lo shmei oil. Those opinions which say that an oil zorok does not work, okay? It's only because it doesn't block the tumah. And it's only on a rabbinic level. This is an important point. The Pnei Yeshua wants to say, and this will become an important point for us, even though there is a majority opinion that an Ohel Zorok does not work, which is a problem for Mr. Cohen, that's a chumrah. That's a stringency. On a Torah level, he wants to say that everybody agrees that an Ohel Zorok will work. Okay, even though there are machmirim, on a Torah level, they would be makel. How does that help us? Mr. Cohen also has to keep rabbinic law, not just Torah law. It'll help us to create tzveikot. Because have a look here in the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer wants to bring here, he's dealing with a specific issue of Mr. Cohen going on a plane. And he brings from Rabbi Yitzchak HaKhanan Spector. When did Rabbi Yitzchak HaKhanan Spector live? At the end of the 19th century in Kovna, the Kovna Rov. Look what he says, number 6. The Tzitz Eliezer says, V'mokam rosh oy la'azkir b'zeh da'ato shel ha'goyna ma'or ha'gola Rabbi Yitzchak HaKhanan Spector. Mikovna, I want to bring you the view of Rabbi Yitzchak HaKhanan. He brings opinion, which is as follows. People weren't flying through the air from Kovna, but they were on a train. They were getting trains across the country, across Russia. He allowed a Kohen to go on a train traveling through a Beit HaKvarot, through a Jewish cemetery. Because in the Sofik Tumah Berushus HaRabim, which we'll see in a minute, he says this is really a Sofik. We don't know if there's exactly it's going to work in a Rushus HaRabim or not. We'll see soon what that means. The Hitzkiva Hekshel is there, Shita Zarashba, and he says we can take account of the Rashba. Sheposik Doel Zorok Shmeol, that says that an Oel Zorok does work, even though he's only a minority. V'chein divrei apnei Yeshua basuka, and so too the view of the Pnei Yeshua that we just saw in number 5. Daha oil zorak loishmei oil hu rak mit rabbonon, who says that even the views that say that an oil zorak doesn't work, that's only on a rabbinic level, on a Torah level, it does work. The in came lefizeh, according to this, says that this Eliezer yesh lefanenu sofek tumah rishus harabim. We have really different levels of sofek of tumah in a public domain. More about that in a second. The sofek command. The suffix command halacha ikar the suffix of who the halacha is like ikar Rashba the Shmei Oil ikar Rambam the Lashmei Oil. Maybe the halacha is like the Rambam, maybe the halacha is like the Rashba. The suffix who mid Rabbanan, the suffix is Rabbanan. What are we trying to do here? Without getting too technical, we're trying to help Mr. Cohen. We're trying to say to Mr. Cohen, look, there's a number of different tzveikot here. Maybe the halacha is like the Rashba, who says that the oil will work, even if it's flying. Maybe the halacha is like the Rambam, that says that the oil won't work. And even if the halacha is like the Machmirim, maybe that's only on a rabbinic level, not a Torah level. And therefore it could be that if Mr. Cohen really doesn't have much of an option, we've managed to create a halachic case for him to be lenient. That's what we're trying to do here. To try to create a halachic case for the Cohen, who has difficulty getting that one flight out of Newark, which doesn't have a mate on it, we're trying to help a situation where he can be lenient. Now, it must be said, that the difference between the flying carpet and the ox could be explained as follows. Tosfos brings this explanation. Why are we more lenient in the case of the ox, where we say that the ox with the door on top is called an OL? Because soft, the ox is on the ground. It may be moving, but it's connected to the ground. And maybe the train, similarly like the ox, you can be lenient because it's not flying through the air, it's connected to the ground. But maybe when something is mamash flying through the air, nobody would be lenient. And that's a really valid way of looking at it, that all of these leniences looking at the train are much more like the case of the ox. In fact, the train and the ox are quite analogous in many ways. It has a wooden train going over the ground. Whereas it could be that the plane, it really wouldn't help you. And we'll see that those poskim who want to be machmir actually are not happy with the plane, even with this analysis. Now, by the way, there was a minhag for Jews living in Jerusalem when the road to Yericho used to go through Har Zeisim. Nowadays, the road to Yericho, there's a big tunnel. You don't have to go over Har Zeisim. But it used to be, back in the day, you had to go over Har Zeisim. There were people who had a minhag that they used to put a wooden board under the car. Okay, they used to put a wooden board under the car so that when they went over the cemetery, if they were Kohanim in the car, the wooden board would act as a chatzitza. Very interesting. I remember when in the 90s, when I was here, I was on a bus once, and the bus was traveling around the Har Zeisim area. It wasn't going through the cemetery, but it was going on a road. The bus stopped. The guy made an announcement, anyone who is a Kohen, please disembark now. I'll pick you up around the other side of the road. The Kohanim got off the bus. We all stayed on the bus. The bus went round the corner. The Kohanim cut across the, you know, a bit of open ground. And they picked them all up on the other side. Why? Because there was a Shiloh. Maybe there are graves underneath this bit of the road. And he said, Kohanim off, we'll pick you up later. I remember that happening. Very interesting. Nowadays, they worked around that, and they worked out where all the graves are and designed things under the road. There's a whole infrastructure, you should know, under the streets of Yerushalayim, designed to contain Tumat Meit. People are on this. People are on top of this. Maybe on top of this is not the right expression. But people have thought this through, and therefore one of the reasons why no one jumps off the bus, I don't know if anyone here has ever been on a bus where they said Kohanim out and Kohanim back on again in 2 minutes, but this actually happened to me. What is this Sofek Tumah in a public domain? This is something people may not have heard about. Look at number 7. What do we normally say with a Sofek D'oraita? Are we lenient or are we strict? We're strict, l'chumra, sofik, d'oraita, l'chumra. But the case with tumah is a little bit different. Look at number 7. Hachi amar Rav Nachman. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, Rav Nachman says the following. Sofik tumah b'rushus harabim hitir lahem. Sofik tumah in a public domain is mutah. Ha-hilchasa mi-soita gamrin, we learn this from soita. Ma-soita b'rushus ha-yochid. The case of a soita, a woman who is accused of adultery, she is a classic sofik. We don't know. We don't know what she did. Did she do something wrong? Did she not? That, by definition, was in a Rishut HaYochid. She did it in a private, locked-in area, not in a public area. Af Tumah Rishut HaYochid. So, too, we're only machmir on a Sofik Tumah in a Rishut HaYochid. Once you're in a Rishut HaRabim, here's another reason to be lenient. And again, Rishut HaRabim here doesn't necessarily mean the way we define it for Shabbat, with walls and it means a public area in a very kind of poshed way, 3, maybe more people in that area. And therefore, that could be a reason to be makel as well. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, the Chelkas Yaakov, comes up with a fascinating svara. He said, okay, a flying carpet maybe will not work. Why? Because the mace is fixed in the ground, and the flying carpet is flying overhead. So that's no good. But what, he said, if the mace is flying together with the carpet? A kind of relativity argument. Meaning, if the mace is on the ground and the carpet's flying overhead, yeah, you can talk about an oil. But what if everything's flying together? If everything's flying together, maybe, Taka, it is an ohel. Maybe it does work. Meaning that's not the case in the Mishnah. And he wants to suggest, and not all the poskim are that happy with this, but he wants to suggest that it could be that if the mace is together with a plane, then that's not the case of the flying carpet and you can be more lenient. It won't help you for flying over the cemetery, but it will help you if the mace is flying with you. The Gemara did not talk about a case where there is a flying carpet and a dead body right under the carpet. Okay, that far the Gemara did not get. Now, two more points before we start to bring some conclusions here. People might have asked already the question, well, one second, why is Mr. Cohen bothered? Is he Tahor? Is anybody Tahor? If Mr. Cohen ever was born in a hospital or went into a hospital probably, Mr. Cohen's already Tamei. So is a Cohen who is already Tamei still worried about being Tamei again? Now, you know the answer to this, which is yes, because otherwise every Cohen would just say, well, it doesn't matter anymore, does it? Let's the school go to the graveyard and go to the cemetery, because we're all tummy. But the question is, why? So for here, we need to look at a nazir. Who is a nazir, or a nazira, is a man or a woman who is not allowed to drink wine or come into contact with a dead body. Have a look here in number 8. Says the Rambam as follows. Nitma lemeit pa'amim harbet. If this nazir became tummy mate, multiple times. Afal pisha hu chayav malchus, I'll call achas ba'achas, l'shamayim. He is, says the Rambam, chayav on every single one, meaning the nazir touched a dead body, or came into a tent. And then he ran next door and did it again, and again, and again, and again, and he never became tahor in between. He just kept coming into contact with new dead bodies. Says the Rambam, you're chayav on every single one. It's a new aveira every time. Ein Beit Din Malkim Oto El Achad, but Beit Din only give him one, because it's all in one unit. Then Hitru Bar, I'll call Pamba Pamba, but if they warned him every time, don't go in there and touch that dead body, and he did. Don't go in there and touch that body, and he did. Vahumatama, look at I'll call Achad Ba'achad. You see here very clearly, the Rambam rules, that even if the Nazir is already Tamei, every time the Nazir comes into contact again and again and again and again, he becomes chayav, he is liable every time again. So clearly the fact that he's already tamei does not take away his prohibition to come into contact with yet another dead body. The only exception he brings is if he's still holding on. If he's still holding on to the first dead body, then touching another one will not add anything. But once he's let go, he's let go. That will apply to Kohenim as well. If a Kohen becomes tamei, then it doesn't help to turn around and say, well, I'm already tamei, then who cares? I may as well just go into the cemetery, because every single tumah would apparently add on to that aveira. That's the Rambam's position. The Rivet says no. And this is going to be very important for us next week, when we're looking at a doctor who wants to be, a Kohen who wants to train to be a doctor, and come into contact with multiple dead bodies and anatomy, etc. The Rivet says no. Okay? On the Rambam there, number 9. Says the Ravid, Ma'ata tumu v'tumah afilu pirish v'chazav anaga potter. He says, I don't think so. I don't think you are chayav if you touch multiple dead bodies. I think you are patur. You are exempt. The Hakohenim bizman hazeh, look what he says. He says it explicitly. Kohenim these days, tamei meitei. They're all already tamei. V'oid ein aleim chiyav tumah. They're not chayav anymore to become tumah all over again. The hama chayav otam. And if you want to tell me that they are, Alav lahavi raya. You, the onus of proof is on you to prove why should a Kohen, who is already tamei, have a problem becoming into new contact? Why? He's already tamei. Zeh, finished. Gamarnu. So what you have is an interesting machlokes between the Rambam and the Rivet. The Rambam says, no, every single time the Kohen becomes tamei again, he's liable again and again and again and again. The Rivet says, no, once you're tamei, well, he says pasur. It's interesting. We'll talk next week about what patur really means. Does patur mean, oh, it's fine? Or does patur just mean, you're off reliable, you don't have a liability in the Beis Din. So we can talk about that. But one way or the other, we seem to have this machlokas where the Kohanim have a problem of ongoing exposure to Tumah once they're already tarry. So can we take that into account? Says Rav Moshe Sternbach, yes and no. Rav Moshe Sternbach says in number 10, it's quite warm in here. Is it warm in here?
Yeah.
Is the heating on or is it just warm? Maybe we could get somebody to ask them to turn the heating off. A little bit of pressure. I'll close it again. Okay. Says Rav Moshe Sternbuch. Maybe I can add a new reason. He's talking about the Kohen on the plane. We'll talk about that in a minute. Who knows who's really a Kohen? And they're already tami. Maybe that's a reason to be makel. Aval mitamim elichas v'shalom lahatir. But I'm not prepared just on these reasons alone to allow it. Meaning these reasons are not impossible. The one that we've just dealt with, which is that the kohen is already tami. Maybe again, what are we trying to do? This is very important. We're trying to build a halachic case. So once we start adding all this together to say to Mr. Cohen, well, you're already tami. Do what you like. That we won't do. But once we're already, well, it's a Sufik, and it's a Drabonon maybe, and it's a Sufik Tumah Berushos HaRabim, and who knows if you're already Tamei, that makes a difference. We can start adding these as a sniff, what's called a sniff, another branch, another issue, Lahatir, to build up a case to be Makel. What is the other thing Rav Moshe Sternbuch said? He raised the question, who is really a Kohen? Now, that's very interesting, because the Gemara distinguishes between two types of Kohen. A Kohen Miyuchas, that's somebody who can trace their lineage back reliably to a Kohen who served in the Mikdash, yeah, of which there are a few. There is, they say the family Rappaport can trace back to the Shach, and he can trace back further. I remember one of my friends who is a Rappaport, when he got married under the Chuppah, the chief rabbi, who was a rabbi there, said, Kohen Miyuchas, and everyone went, psh, yeah. But most Kohanim are what are called Kohanim Muchzakim. They have a chazakah. What does a chazakah mean? I can't prove, says Mr. Cohen, that I'm a Cohen. But it's like the old joke, but my father was a Cohen, and my grandfather was a Cohen, and my great-grandfather, at least they told me they were. And they had a tradition that they were all Cohenim. Are we prepared to turn round to Mr. Cohen, who's looking for a way to get on the plane with a maester, and say, well, I don't know if you're a Cohen or not. So the Rav Moshe Sternbuch said, Chas v'shalom, we should turn round to Cohenim and just say that. But as another reason, maybe. Now, we have to be very careful with this. Because we don't normally say this. We don't go around to people and say, who knows if you're really a Kohen? For example, every time, as you well know, a Kohen has a firstborn son, or a wife who is a bat Kohen, then they don't have a pidyon haben. Everybody knows this. If we really turn around and said, well, who knows who's really a Kohen, then everybody should make a pidyon haben. Make it without a brocha. Okay, but we don't turn around and say that everyone has to make a pidyon haben just in case they're not a Kohen. Why don't we? Pidyon haben is a mitzvah d'oraita. Clearly, we don't really take that into account. We assume that whoever is a Kohen knows that they're a Kohen, and there really is a Kohen. What if they're a chalal? This is the question, really. What is a chalal? A chalal is a child born from a Kohen and a woman the Kohen is not allowed to marry. For example, who is a Kohen not allowed to marry? A grusha, a divorcee, a chalala, another woman who is herself invalid to marry a Kohen, or a zona. A zona is not what the modern word in Hebrew indicates. A zona is a woman who's had a past sexual relationship with certain people that she's not allowed to, including a non-Jewish man. If a woman has had a sexual relationship with a non-Jewish man, she may not then go on to marry a Kohen. So the question is, who is and who is not really a Kohen? Do we turn, and this is, like Lamaisa, this is an interesting question. You have a young Baal Tshuva girl. I deal with these questions because I deal with this crowd. A young girl who is a Baal Tshuva, she became religious after college, and she falls in love with a young guy, and lo and behold, he's a Kohen. And she has a history, she's a Baal Tshuva, and the question is, can she get married to him? And the answer, Pashtus, is no, you can't get married to him. So the question is, can you say, well, is he really a Kohen or is he not a Kohen? And we don't normally turn around and say, he's not a Kohen, although, again, it's not so straightforward. Is he a Kohen? Maybe, and now as we get further into multiple generations of Baal Tshuva, Maybe his mother was also a Baal Tshuva back in the 70s, okay? And she married his father, Mr. Cohen, but maybe she also shouldn't have married his father. Because maybe she was also technically disqualified from marrying the father, which means that he isn't the Cohen. Which means that he can marry this young lady. But how far do we go with that? Do we start recreating entire families? Think of the implications for that. You want to try and find a way for young Mr. Cohen to marry this Baal Tshuva. In so doing, you turn around and said that his parents' relationship is possible, is invalid. It's not so straightforward to get into that, but this is a question that we often come up with. Fine. So that's the question of who is and who isn't really a Cohen. So what do we do? Does Mr. Cohen need to leave the plane or not? Now, when the plane's in flight, there's not a lot that can be done. But let's say the Cohen finds out as he's about to board the plane, or he's already sitting on the runway. Someone runs into the passenger area and say, "We've just discovered there's a mate on the plane." That's it. Does he have to run out? So look at number 11. Shulchan Aruch says, Cohen Shehu Yash, a Cohen who is sleeping, Umeis Alav, Umeis Imo Boel. And it turns out that there is a mace with him in the building. Someone dies, someone just tells him he died. Shrichim Lakito. You have to wake him up, says the Shulchan Aruch. Ulagidlo kidei shiyete. Yeah, you have to tell him so he can get out. Meaning you do have to wake people up. But Pashas, you would have to tell him to leave. The Shach there, I didn't bring you the Shach. The Shach gets into a whole argument there as to where maybe if you can make an argument that Tumah is the Rabbanon. Again, you have to know your stuff, which I'm not an expert on this, but it's not so simple. If the Tumah is the Rabbanon, then maybe the Kohen doesn't have to leave. Maybe he'd have to get out of a train and stand in a snowy area and stand there and it will be dangerous. Could be that there are reasons that the Kohen may not have to leave. This Shaila comes up, for example, in modern day scenarios. Let's say you have a chazan on Yom Kippur, who is a Kohen, and he's in the middle of his big Yom Kippurdik Kedusha, and then somebody in the back, there's a kafufel at the back of the, and some nebach, somebody dies at the back of the shul. Do we have to pull the chazan off and say to him, right, you're out, let's get a new fellow to start, and maybe he has to start all over again from the beginning of Chazaras Hashat, which will be quite a lot of fun on Yom Kippur, or do we turn around and say, no, let him carry on? It's an interesting question. Also, if the Kohenim in the middle of Birkas Kohenim, if they're in the middle of Birkas Kohenim and somebody expires at the back of the shul, do we have to scream, everybody out? Or no, you have to know what your tumah is, yes.
How is this different from the Rambam's case with Nazir, that if you're already touching a mate?
Because they're not touching a mate. That's touching. Touching means mamash touching. It's tumah b'chiburim. Tumah b'chiburim means I'm actually physically holding onto a mate. If I'm touching something else, it doesn't work. But being in the same, being in an OL, it's not Tumul Chiburin. Tumul Chiburin is touching. So there's yet another reason maybe we can be lenient. Let's have a look at the bottom line and see where it takes us. In summary, Pashtus Mr. Cohen has got a bit of a problem. Because we're not sure that this OL will work when he's in flight. But there are a number of reasons to be lenient, potentially. Number one, we said the floor of the plane may act to block the Tumah. And we talked about that last week. Maybe even if it doesn't work to block the tumah, as we said, probably the best answer is that the tumah will just go straight through and through the roof. Ohel Zoruk, some say yes, some say no. Maybe we can resolve it leniently as a sophic tumah on a rabbinic issue in Rishus HaRabim. Maybe there isn't even a mace on the plane, okay? Maybe the Kohen's not really a Kohen. Maybe the Kohen is already tame and therefore it doesn't, I mean, none of these reasons alone will be enough. But all of these reasons together may indeed be enough. So how do the poskim react? Well, differences of opinion. Rav Moshe Feinstein was actually quite machmir. He said that really Mr. Cohen has to try and find another flight if he possibly can. Rav Herschel Schechter and Rav Mordechai Willig in YU are also reported to be quite machmir on this issue as well. Rav Schechter seems to hold, and I've not got to the bottom of this exactly, I gave you some sources at the bottom in the footnotes, Rav Schechter seems to hold that the tumah may indeed break through the floor of the plane, but then spread through the passenger section and not go through the roof. So it could be that the Kohanim are actually bound, have a problem of this, even though they're not right above the mace. Again, we would have to go into exactly why he holds this. On the other hand, Rav Schechter does have a leniency, which is when it comes to the mace on the cemetery, someone flying over a cemetery, Rav Schechter says, maybe you don't have to start putting plastic bags on, and we talked about that last week. Why? He brings a very interesting svara. He says that what is the issa? The issa is for a Kohen to be close to a mace, to come karov to a mace. He says, if you're flying thousands of feet in the air and there's a mace on the ground, how could you possibly ever understand that to be the Kohen being close, Kohen to be close to the mace? Meaning, yeah, you can build a technical argument, someone goes all the way up, but come on, thousands of feet away, you're not close to anything. He wants to bring that as a reason to be lenient, but of course, that wouldn't help you if the mace is on the plane, because there you right are, you're right there. Rav Moshe Sternbuch has an interesting approach, which appears to be, in principle, lenient. He says here in number 12, Olechein nira lahachmir v'kohen. He says, I think you should be machmir. You'll see in a minute why I said he's lenient. Machmir with a kohen shalol atus b'matos la'eretz Yisrael. He shouldn't fly to Eretz Yisrael ela im birer kifi ha'esha, unless he tries to check out as much as he possibly can. She'ein sham meis, that there's no meis on the plane. The rak ad linsoa, only then should he travel to Eretz Yisrael. Ubizmana acharon, he writes here, in recent years, shamati, I have heard, shehitkinu lemeisim b'matos aron, mechomer miyuchad ke'em plastic. I hear that they have made a plastic ohel, a plastic structure, she'ein makabel tumah, which is not receptive to tumah. Ve'in poteach tefach, and if it's constructed in such a way that it leaves the tefach this much over the mace, which is necessary to roof it in, she'ein tumah bokar, so the tumah won't come up. Ve'hiskimu lazeh migdolei haposkim. This he says, I'll go with. This I'm happy with. If you know that the plastic thing is there, I'll go with it. Aval tzarich biruri, you need to check. She'oid lo hitkinu kein. They haven't necessarily brought it in b'chol makom, in every place, on every flight. V'yesh levaver hadava hasiv. You need to check that the plastic thing is here. But, if you listen to what he said, he seems to say that if the plastic structure is there, he's okay with that. Ah, what about ohel zoruk? Maybe the plastic structure doesn't work. He clearly thinks it does. As long as the plastic thing is there, he's happy. He's happy to go. So you see there that Rav Moshe Sternbuch is more lenient slightly on this if the plastic structure is there. Other people are also more lenient, certainly lenient on the question of whether you're allowed to transport the mate. Meaning you, as a non-Kohen, are you allowed to even arrange for a mate to be taken on a plane? Aren't you going to be responsible for being Matama the Kohanim? So the poskim there, Rav Yaakov Reich, others as well, seem to be lenient because they say, look, you don't know that there's a Kohen there. You're assuming that there's going to be a Kohen there. And if there is a Kohen there, you're assuming that all these problems are going to occur. Maybe they won't. Maybe they're resolvable, etc. And therefore, that doesn't seem to be a problem really at all. So where does that leave us, bottom line, before we get to our postscripts? Can a Kohen go on a plane if there is a mace on the plane? And the answer is, depends who you ask. It really depends who you ask. There are poskim who are machmir and say, look, at the end of the day, if you have another alternative, go to Newark Airport, drive like an hour and a half to New Jersey if you're in America, and take a flight there. It's a bit more expensive. Well, that's not. I mean, you have to do what you can. However, it may depend. There are poskim who are lenient. And it may depend on why you're traveling on a plane. Are you traveling to do a mitzvah? Are you going there to see family? Are you going there for an important simcha? Is it kibbutz av ha'eim? These are all factors, because then it's not just you're weighing the halachic shaila, not just on the downside of going on the plane, but on the downside of not going on the plane. What if, as in one particular case, somebody was stranded for Pesach? This was when Obama was in Israel, and they closed all the airspace. And the only way they could get to Israel by was going on one of these flights. Otherwise, they were going to be away from their family for Pesach. Is that a factor that you could, if you're away for Pesach, then maybe we can start relying on this, that, and the other. So it's a complicated halachic diyun. There's not only one downside, but there's another downside, and therefore a real posek will have to analyze that in a very serious way. Let me just end with something that I couldn't resist. My son actually pointed this out to me, and when he said it, I said, oh yes, you're right, I must put that in. We saw an amazing thing. The Gemara, the Mishnayos talk about flying through the air in a box into Chutz La'aretz. Mamash ma'anyen. And by the way, there are other Gemaras that talk about if you fly through the air and you land on Shabbos, can you get off or can you not get off? Because is there an issue of tchum? And it talks about Eliyahu HaNavi, when Eliyahu HaNavi comes back eventually, you know, if he lands, as it were, from wherever he is, will he be able to get out? If it's Shabbos, if it's not Shabbos. The Gemara does deal with those. And if you remember, we had the case when we talked about the surrogacy case. Remember that many moons ago? We talked about a situation where a brilliant Talmudic farmer decides to back, two cows are back to back. Do you remember this? It's those who were here. Maybe I'll outline it for those who weren't here. The case there was we were trying to work out in the din of Bechor. A newborn animal, if it's born to a kosher animal, a newborn male is a Bechor. A firstborn male is a Bechor. If you have a cow at home, Daisy, or a sheep, I don't know what you call a sheep, Dolly, okay? If you have one of these kosher animals and it gives birth to a firstborn male, so that firstborn male is a Bechor. Now, back in the day when we had Kohanim, Mikdash, this was a big simcha. You take your Bechor, you give it to the Kohen would bring it as a Korban, everyone would dance and sing, everybody's happy. Today, there's nothing you can do with a Bechor. It's a pain in the neck. Nobody wants a Bechor. Because you can't kill it. You can't shear it. You can't eat it. You can't work it. It runs around the farm like a meshuggah animal. Like a wildebeest, or like a wildebeest. And it runs around the end of the farm, and there's nothing you can do. Nobody wants a firstborn male. Says the Gemara, every farmer's davening for a girl first. Okay? Because then at least if number two is a boy, then that's fine. So the Gemara there in Chulin, I should have brought the source, but if you remember, the Gemara there in Chulin says a very fascinating thing. He says, what happens if a very clever Talmudic farmer decides to do the following? Let's back two cows up against each other. One which is about to give birth to a Bechor, that for sure is a Bechor, there's nothing I can do to avoid that. And a second cow who is not pregnant at all. And let's back them up, says the Gemara, in such a way that the fetus will come out of the first cow, back up into the second cow, do a little pirouette, okay, and come out of the second cow. Now, everyone agrees that this little fetus, this newborn animal, is a Bechor. You can't get around that. But what that farmer has managed to do is, if you don't mind my mixed metaphors, he's killed two birds with one stone. He's used one Bechor for two cows. The first cow, who for sure was the original cow that carried this Bechor, and this very unfortunate second cow who's been brought in and somehow temporarily managed to get this fetus in and out again, and now it's had, quote unquote, it's had a baby. So the Gemara there actually says, the first cow, Itaka works, because the first cow was the mother and also gave birth to, carried and gave birth to the cow. But the second cow is just a birth mother. And how do we know? A birth mother, maybe not the mother. And the Gemara leaves it as a question. Tosfos in Ksubas makes a fascinating list of all the weirdest Gemaras you could imagine. And we've had some pretty weird ones today, an interesting one. He said, here's my all-time star favorite list of strange Gemaras. And he lists this one, someone swallowed a weasel, this and that. You know, there's all sorts of weird things that the Gemara brings. But then he gets to this one about the Bechor, and he says, well, come on, this one is just like, come on. This is not just unlikely. Meaning, I don't mind unlikely. Unlikely is good, because unlikely cases are often the most extreme and therefore define the law most precisely. By analogy, if I'm dealing with the laws of murder, then the Gemara is not interested in asking a case if someone, God forbid, goes into a hall of people and shoots them all. Is that murder? I don't need the Gemara to raise that kind of case. Pashut. The Gemara is more interested in the kind, I don't think the Gemara discusses this, but this kind of case. If a person, you know, jumps off a building, God forbid, to commit suicide, and then as he's flying past the window on the third floor, just milliseconds before he hits the ground, somebody decides to shoot him then. That's a very interesting case, because you shot someone who was milliseconds away from death. Anyway, now, could that ever happen? Did that ever happen? That's not the point, is it? The point is that it's defined. But so as for this, come on. Every Talmudic farmer knew full well that you can't take one fetus out from a cow and put another. It says Tosfos, you can't ever take an embryo out from one mother and implant it in another mother. Ain't that back as there? Why would the Gemara discuss this? Now, of course, we said then when we talked about surrogacy, this is now a key source. This is now a source, because we do now do, not exactly this, but we take embryos from here, we grow them there, we put them here, we had a few shirim about this. And therefore, the Gemara does have fascinating situations where it describes things flying through the air in a box, this issue of the flying carpet. It's amazing that it does. But I couldn't resist you, just as a last postscript, the Rambam in the Shmona Parakim. The Rambam talks there, nothing to do with halacha, nothing to do with Kohanim. He wants to talk there about the power of the intellect and the power of the imagination. The Rambam understood that these two parts, these two aspects of the brain were channeled in very different ways. And learning comes through one and prophecy comes through the other. He made a lot of this. So when he's talking about the imagination, he gives a few examples. Look at number 13. Hachenik ha-medame. the part of the brain which is imaginative. What is that? What does that do? How does that work? Lefikach, therefore he says, Yarkiv zeh hakoach, this power of imagination can take min advarim asher hisigam, from that which we did see, which exists in the world. We look around us as children and as grown-ups, we see certain things. We can take those things and create from them dvarim shelo hisigam klal, things which we never saw. Imagination can extrapolate from that which we did to that which we never saw. The eshal hisigam, and things that could never be. Not only things that weren't yet, but things that could never be. And the Rambam is searching around trying to find, what is an example of something, says the Rambam in the 12th century, that could never ever be. Kamoi, like someone, sheyidame ha'adam, if a person were to imagine, sfinat barzel rasasabavir, a ship of metal flying through the air. Says the Rambam, that is the ultimate thing that you could imagine that could never be. I'd love to take the Rambam to Ben Gurion Airport and say, Rabbeinu Moshe, look at these. These are metal ships that fly through the air. And he says, Va'adam Shirosho B'Shamayim V'Ragla Ba'aretz, someone who is thousands of feet tall, or Chaya Ba'alat Elef Einayim, or an animal with a thousand eyes, what you and I call science fiction today. But the example he gives, very fascinating, is the metal ship flying through the air. And I brought you even an example of a flying battleship, if you're interested, at the bottom there, or what could be a flying battleship. And therefore, I think this is a good way to conclude that even though imagination is a wonderful thing, the Gemara really does raise these questions, and Mr. Cohen has to ask his Shaila to his local Orthodox qualified rabbi. Next week we go on to doctors and hospitals, and then we'll finish this area and we'll move on. And again, Tu Bishvat, please God, in 3 weeks from now.